to the views that are expressed here, not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being until we ask for them. We have with us again Mr. Edward Temperlake, and Mr. Temperlake has written a book with Jeff Bevan called Showdown, subtitled Why China Wants War with the United States. Let me just repeat that. Why China Wants War with the United States. Now, Mr. Temperlake, actually an Annapolis graduate, he was a Marine fighter pilot. He's held all sorts of positions, key positions, working in government and working associated with some of the congressional committees. Jeff Bevan has a similar background as far as working at the upper echelons of government. And, well, anyway, Jeff was supposed to be with us. He couldn't, and so Edward was good enough to come on with us once again. So let's explore really what this book is about. It's about the fact that China really is planning for a war with the United States, aren't they?
Yes, sir, they are. It is a very deliberate buildup of military weapons. It's a very deliberate structuring of their propaganda message. It's a very deliberate asymmetric. And what do I mean by that? That's a threat in which you don't go right at your opponent's strengths, but you try and come around the corner hitting their weaknesses. And the People's Republic of China have studied across the board how effective and capable and actually brilliant the American military forces have become over time. And we're very good at what we do. You know, as a former Marine fighter pilot, I'm very proud of my fellow aviators still serving and still defending. And the bottom line is the People's Republic of China read our literature, see our actions, see the devastation we can wrought on the enemies of America, and they study it wisely, and then they take all the money that has been building up in their coffers through the asymmetric trade, in which it seems to only go one way. They get the benefit of the dollars, and we get some cheap Chinese goods. And the bottom line is they take that money and buy homegrown stuff, not very good, by the way, and a lot of Soviet or Russian stuff. And actually, it comes from the old Soviet Empire. That's when the last design blueprints were struck and the castings made and the flankers and the floggers, which are NATO code words for the Su-27 and the Su-30MK high-performance jet aircraft. Very similar, by the way, to F-15 skis, we used to call them. So the Chinese have bought these weapons across the board. Sovereignty, destroyers, which are shoot-and-die ships to take out our carriers, and their second artillery, which is both strategic, and we can talk a little bit about their aiding and abetting North Korea in their bad behavior on this potential missile launch. But independent of that, they have grown a very capable missile force on the coast of China. Most estimates put it about 790 intermediate-range missiles, that any one of which hitting the center of a carrier deck would wreak hell and havoc on the carrier and maybe put it in the bottom of the ocean. As an Annapolis grad, I get very concerned when you see opponents building these weapons, because I'll ask any listener with an earshot of my voice, name one natural enemy China has. There's not a single country in the world that would be arrogant or dumb enough to wake up in the morning and say, I think we'll invade or attack or pick a fight with China. They just don't do that. That country is so huge, it has such land mass and a population of 1.3 billion, that you wouldn't even consider doing that. So you have to ask, why are they building these offensive anti-satellite weaponry, these offensive cyber operations, computer operations?
Hold that thought there, please, yes. For just a moment. We'll be right back with Mr. Temperlake. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And our guest today is Mr. Edward Temperlake, and he was a graduate of Annapolis. He is a Marine fighter pilot, but for many years he's held key positions with various congressional committees and study groups in Washington, D.C. And he and Jeff Bevan have written a wonderful book called Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States. And, of course, right today our emphasis is on the threat of Iran. Iran may be able to get nuclear weapons, a threat to the world. Well, I'll tell you, a great, much greater threat to the world is communist China, which is not only building up its own military, but it's helping the North Koreans. Do you honestly think that North Korea, that can't even, create enough food to feed its people, and its people are starving to death, and millions have died of starvation? Do you really think they have technology to build intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons without tremendous help from their good friends in communist China? What about that?
Well, actually, to go back even 10 years to take the history of this, there was a DIA analyst, a Defense Intelligence Agency individual, who was quoted open source about 8 years ago, that he took the template, or the blueprint, if you will, of a North Korean missile and a Chinese missile, and he put the Chinese blueprint over the North Korean blueprint of the same missile, and it matched down to the rivets. So the missilery, the rocketry coming out of North Korea is wholly and totally manufactured or designed in communist China. I also know this from a different, totally different aspect. And this is reported, again, going back 6 years ago. There was a C-130, a large heavy-lift cargo airplane that we manufacture called the Hercules. It was had the colors on the side painted of the Indian Air Force, the Pakistani Air Force, excuse me very much, Pakistani Air Force. It would take off from Pakistan and land in China for refueling purposes and then go into a hangar and then go into North Korea. It would then reverse the flight, leave North Korea, land in the same airfield in China, go into a hangar, and then return to Pakistan. Over time, it became obvious. What was happening was that the individual who knew how to build nuke or atomic weaponry was a rogue scientist in Pakistan, a gentleman since identified, kind of Dr. Nuke, I think, is his moniker.
I think his name is Khan, wasn't it?
Yes, there it is. It's Khan. And this is the gentleman that was really perfecting how to export this material, this way of thinking, and the North Koreans took advantage of it.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Ed. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I guess is Mr. Edward Temperlake, and we're talking about the North Korean missile capacity, the North Korea's atomic capacity, and Edward was just saying that this really is coming out of Pakistan, and that it was being shipped from Pakistan into communist China, and then into Korea, and this is not North Korean homegrown at all. Pakistan and China are helping North Korea develop a nuclear and missile technology. And, of course, the frightening thing is all our attention is focused on, the terrible danger of North Korea. And we focus on that without recognizing the real danger. And that's communist China, who has always been our enemy. In fact, we're doing everything we can to create the best enemy money could buy.
So you're exactly right. And as that 130, that Hercules, that cargo plane landed in North Korea, it upgraded their new capability to the point where they actually achieved the weapon, reversed the flight path. It leaves North Korea, goes into the hangar, and then goes on to Pakistan. That's when it was carrying parts and capability for missilery. And the Pakistani government appreciatively took a lot of the designs from the People's Republic of China and increased their strategic missile force against India. So you had this very, very nasty route of flight with this one aircraft going into China and both building up the North Korean atomic capability and the Pakistan missile capability. Consequently, thank God that Pakistan now is helping America as much as we can hopefully or maybe even more expect, but at least they're doing the right thing. I feel very sympathetic for their president. He's in a very precarious position, that is the president of Pakistan. He's got a lot of people that don't like him who are very violent and vicious, and he seems to be a very responsible individual. But on the North Korean side, let's look at that guy. He's a little bit different. He really does have some severe problems. Megalomania seems to be one of them, in which he has designs of grandeur, thinks his capabilities are far stronger and more powerful than they are, but they're powerful enough to do one important thing, which is to get America's attention. Because very recently, and your listeners have been following this, I'm sure, because they're concerned, and I'm talking to Monterey, California, mind you, that they decided they would take a test shot. So over the course of the last week, they've been preparing the Taipaldong II missile, which is named for the launch pad, by the way, and getting it ready, fueling it. Apparently, according to open source press reporting, they had some weather holes, and no one can figure out exactly when they're going to light it off, and now if they're going to light it off. And why do I say that? Because I think they grossly miscalculated. The People's Republic of China, I think, allowed the North Koreans to set up this missile shot as kind of a signal that, hey, the North Koreans are to be taken seriously. You really should have create a framework to engage them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of diplomatic speak, meaning let's go to the table and talk to these fellows. Well, that's not the response they got. The response they got is a tribute to Ronald Reagan. To remind everybody, he was mocked. I worked for Ronald Reagan in the Defense Department in the 80s. I respected that man tremendously as president, and the legacy will go on for my children's children's lives. He was so good. The bottom line is that he was mocked because a lot of people said, oh, what are you talking about, President Reagan? Your anti-missile system is called Star Wars. Ha ha, it won't come to pass. Well, the Clinton administration kind of put it on a shelf after the 92 time period, and not much was done. Well, President Bush, the current president, came in with a very dedicated, prior to 9/11, a very dedicated mission to support, upgrade, and turn on our best scientific and engineering brains into creating an anti-ballistic missile system, a missile defense system, especially designed. How much foresight is this? Especially designed against North Korea and Iran and countries like that. Bottom line is, when the North Koreans decided to test our resolve, all of a sudden, we stood up and said, wait a minute, we now can put ships, U.S. and Japanese ships, out there with Standard III missiles. It's a Navy ship-launched anti-air and actually anti-missile system that can reach out to about 90 miles. Then you have I just announced putting the Patriot into Japan. You have the issue of the anti-ballistic missile going operational out of Fort Greely, Alaska, and up and down the Pacific coast. We don't have that many, and our success has been marginally good, and the program has been developing. But in effect, what the North Koreans have done is they've given us a test vehicle. Your listeners may not know this, but I just read recently where it cost about $100 million to get a good test shot, and they're giving us something to shoot at. Well, hit or miss, the North Koreans have proved my point and the point of all my fellow, what we call blue team analysts, those who are, you know, blue in the war game, thinking the red team, the people supporting communist China, are wrong. Well, our blue team has scored a major victory here, because I don't think there's a single politician in America now that can mock or laugh at or try and avoid the responsibility of voting for and increasing our anti-missile systems. There is a possibility, remote, but there is a possibility, and I don't want to start panic here, that the North Korean missile could turn out to be a piece of junk when you finally launch it. But it could fall on Japan, it could hit Hawaii, it could hit the coast of Alaska, it could even reach the continental United States, where I'm speaking right now to the people of Monterey, California. I don't think it's going to be the case, but why take that chance? Let's keep going, let's keep building a missile. That calculus, that political, economic, and engineering calculus that the American Defense Department has come up with is very powerful, and it's been turned on. The People's Republic of China have a problem.
Well, of course, the thing that bothers me is we've only got 6 missiles, and China's got 15 missiles, and Russia's got 1,000 of them or something like that.
In fact, actually, the number on China open source published, even when I was on the Hill, is about 28.
All right, well, so we got 6 anti-ballistic missiles. We're not sure.
So we don't have that many.
And, of course, why is it that there has been an organized effort to block, you know, implementation of what they could? They, even under Ronald Reagan, they could have put up at least brilliant pebbles.
Brilliant pebbles.
They could have certainly deployed something. We keep talking about it and talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, but we don't have anything deployed. And even though back under the Carter administration, we had a system that worked and worked very well with had small nuclear devices on them, and they would have ticked out the missiles, but gee, today, almost 30 years later, we can't figure out how to do it. We disbanded an effective anti-ballistic missile system in the 70s because it was too expensive to maintain. And now we're spending billions of dollars to build a system that, at least so far, is rather unproven.
It's been hit or miss. That's very, very accurate, sir. I agree with that. But they're getting better. I've actually shot missiles. As a Marine fighter pilot, I've gone on missile exercises where I've launched under the wing of my aircraft Sparrow homing missiles and Sidewinder heat-seeking missiles. What I've found, my personal experience, is that a contractor will sell to the Defense Department tremendous capability. You will get a briefing that this device will solve all your problems. It will be masterful. It will do this, 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 and this. And they define it very well. And you know what? It usually doesn't work that way the first, second, or third time. But ultimately, and this is where the American can-do know-how finally gets around to fixing things, ultimately, maybe years later, and you're right, time is something that is very precious, but years later, the ultimate performance of the system as it was originally marketed comes to pass. And that is evident in the shoot-down statistics of the most recent engagement with Iraq. We just can take down their aircraft and Gulf One, no problem. That's when they flew them, not in the most recent, I'm sorry, but in Desert Storm. Our AMRAAM and Sparrow and Sidewinder missiles are tremendous. Well, that's the air launch stuff. It's hard, it's miniature, it's small. But when you start to put stuff on rails that can take down and missiles coming in from outer space or the high altitude, the geometry, and the engineering science behind it is pretty difficult. I mean, bullets with bullets is how they call it, trying to hit a bullet with a bullet. But you know what? We're going to get there. And this North Korean posturing to launch, I think it's given, thank God I'm on your radio, has given people with your vision and other talk show hosts the guidance and the feeling that, yes, we were right all along. And it's not nasty when you're right. Have 1 second of saying, gee, I told you so. And you know what? All of us did over years and years and years who championed the need for anti-ballistic missile technology can finally look at people who got in our way, who said no, yes, how would you conceive of a use for this, and said no or wouldn't give us the money. I'm not holding anybody less responsible than kind of both political parties at times, although the Republicans have been much stronger on this, much better. And it happened. And now, when we need it, we're almost there. We're not quite. But the next time, maybe we'll be a little bit better. And finally, we will have the deterrence in place so that American heartland, all our citizens are protected because of the far-sighted nature of the American military today investing in this technology. And kudos to the Bush administration for coming in on this platform and getting on it prior to 9/11, which is factually accurate. They had this as one of their highest defense priorities.
But how soon do you think there will really be any safety? I mean, if we've got six and the Russians got 1,000, that's not a very good. Or we got six and the Chinese communists have 26, we've got six interceptors. Will we have an anti-ballistic missile system in place soon enough to protect us in case of World War III and a nuclear war?
No, sir. In fact, when Ronald Reagan was asked that question, he said, well, he'd rather have fewer hit America than as many as they have. To stop them all when they get into the 1,000 range is almost impossible, and the damage is extensive. That's why you do have the famous quote from, I think it was Dr. Herman Kahn years ago, when countries, the old Soviet and the Americans face off in a Cold War world, you have the quote, famous scorpions in a bottle. Both sides can't sting each other because to sting one is to take out the other. You'd both die.
Well, because we used to have something called mutual assured destruction,
yes,
but the Russians have an effective anti-ballistic missile system, and we don't have one. So it looks to me like it's not so much assured mutual destruction. It's just assured destruction for America. We'll be back in just a moment there to get Mr. Timberlake's response. And, of course, I'm simply suggesting it used to be mutual assured destruction, but the Russians have deployed an anti-ballistic missile system, and we don't have one. Well, we got six, but, I mean, they must have many hundreds, if not thousands of them, don't they?
No, actually, this is gruesome talk, but we can actually wipe almost everyone off the face of the earth if we have to. We still have that capability in our boomers.
But of course, we've already been instructed, and the order is still there that Clinton put in, that we would absorb a first nuclear strike. In other words, they could just destroy anything they wanted to. We wouldn't respond until the first strike was over. What would happen at that point? You know, after, let's imagine that they should kill 100 million Americans. Would we have the courage to retaliate if they said, well, we're going to come in and kill the rest of them?
I believe we would. I think the American fortitude and the ability. My dad was on, he was on the USS Henry Clay. He put one of those subs in commission, and he stood sentry duty out. He was on the Atlantic side. And those submariners who are still out there right now, and thank you to their families for, like my mom, who put up with an awful lot of days where she had no contact with my dad, they're out there on patrol as we speak. We have a lot of capability to retaliate, and the world will know and feel that. Where the real issue, I think, is important is the countries that are unstable. Now, I think Russia's okay right now, although I wouldn't bet everything on it. But in a hierarchy of instability, you have to look at both Iran and North Korea. And Iran, by the way, if they ever launch anything, it's a 6 minutes flight time into Tel Aviv, which is very scary to me because they have threatened to wipe the Jewish race off the face of the earth. They're a horrible anti-Semitic government right now, and that's a great concern. I mean, they want another Holocaust. They want to destroy Israel. And it's 6 minutes, by the way. That's why the Israeli Arrow system, which was mocked or kind of told to me as a patriot, the American defense system on steroids, it's very good, is important. So in the Middle East, you have Iran, and you can hopefully try and stop them. It could be hard, and that's why you really don't want them to get nukes. In North Korea, it's a different case in that they already have nukes, but they don't have that many missiles, and they're not very adept at hiding them. So the bottom line is, if you can stop a country like North Korea with our anti-ballistic missile system, you then can deal with them and take them apart and get the dear leader and drive him out to, you know, his reward wherever he's going.
Well, of course,
get him out of there.
But is North Korea the real enemy? The real enemy, at least my thought, would be communist China, who wants a war with the United States.
Yes, so that's where I'm going with it.
Okay, go ahead.
The reason why the North Korean thing is scary is because they're operating as a testing bed for the People's Republic of China, which is the focus of our book, Showdown. We put the blame firmly on the regime in Beijing for most of this trouble. Now, this is where mutually assured destruction and the old Cold War calculus may not work. And that's a scary thought, because the People's Republic of China, who have 28 and potentially MIRV capability, because thank you very much of Bill Clinton winking and nodding at companies like Loral upgrading the Chinese missiles and fixing them, that gave them tremendous capability. So we have to deter a strategical nuclear strike from the People's Republic of China, or just a clumsy attack on America, and then deal with them conventionally. And that's hopefully where we keep them contained. The problem we have, though,
hold that thought right there. I'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Edward Temperlake, and we're talking about the Korea is really a surrogate. North Korea is a surrogate for communist China. The real threat is communist China, and they seem to be really planning on a war with America so that they can have hegemony over the Far East. In other words, they want to be the top dog over there. They don't want America, threatening them. They don't want to have to worry about American intervention. They want to be able to take Taiwan, and so Edward was just telling us how he thinks we can manage that, because my concern is they wouldn't be concerned about the death of 200 million people. I mean, this would be a little distress to them. They don't put that much value in human life. But if we lost 200 million people, what would happen to America? So you pick up the story there.
Yes, I will. To digress at one point on your issue of casualties, and then I'll go back to the point of the danger of what the leaders in China are saying. The French intellectuals, I'm jumping to France now, but there's a point to my story here. French intellectuals, very liberal, Frenchmen, right, exactly, created a book, or wrote a book called The Black Book of Communism. It's a very, very strong expose, and what they did is they looked around the world and they determined who was the biggest mass murderer in history, and it was Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong, this is Frenchmen now talking, laid off on Mao Zedong the death of between 70 and 80 million of his fellow citizens. So your point about them taking casualties and taking blood, they're willing to do it to themselves. So let's pick up with that. The People's Republic of China, having built a very important and powerful military operation, isn't there yet. They're not quite as capable as they should be to take us on, but they're growing quickly. What they did is they looked at our ability to strike conventionally, but to take our precision-guided munitions, the stuff that hones in on GPS signals, and destroy things with pinpoint accuracy. Trust me, anybody hearing this, it's real. We can do it. Well, their head of their war college about 8 months ago said, if you Americans go into Taiwan to defend it and use all your high-tech capability, we may immediately just throw a nuke at you. I didn't say it quite that way, but that's what he said. That was the second time in the last 8 years that over Taiwan, the government of China has postured, which is a diplomatic word for saying bullied or threatened, the use of nuke attack on American forces over Taiwan as an instrument of state statement, state policy coming out of China. That threshold usually is never discussed. It's never put on the table because of what we talked about previously, mutual assured destruction. You throw an atomic weapon at us, we throw it at you. Well, the People's Republic of China are talking about fighting with it and using it. Now, that gives people pause, because if you're sitting in Tokyo and the North Koreans have a missile and they have nuke capability and they may put one on top of it someday, Tokyo is not that far from the launch pad in North Korea. So if the Chinese communists let North Korea play like that and they tell America they're going to come at us with nukes, the poor Japanese are stuck in the middle here, and they may have to start coming up the military deterrence threshold and engage with some real serious thinking about how do they structure their military to stop China. And all of a sudden, all across the Pacific Rim, you have a lot of very nervous countries who are very democratic and very fair and very open and very innocent and very decent, all worried about the military might of China. That adds to the instability of the Pacific Rim, and a few miscalculations, as we show in Showdown, our book, we have six different scenarios, that any one of those scenarios could come to pass, a war over Japan, a war over Korea, each one is independent as we describe in the future what could happen, a war on the Korean Peninsula, a war over Japan, a war over Taiwan, an internal breakup of the Chinese government, which makes them turn around and use computer and cyber warfare against America, a war over oil. The People's Republic of China have some serious instability problems with their population. They have people who want to be free. My co-author and I have often said, we have a very good system in America. You know, it is the world leader in a constitutional democracy. We've invented that. People follow us. They look to us. They respect us. Inside our system, we have good and bad people. Make no mistake about it. The People's Republic of China has a very bad system of government. Inside that, they have good and bad people. Our heart, our book, our plan is to try and awaken America to have a strong defense and then watch and wait and hope and pray and help China crumble from within with the freedom-loving people of China who deserve better than their puppet masters and their totalitarian dictating Politburo members and generals in Beijing. So we are very much in favor on the side of the Chinese students at Tiananmen who paid a terrible price. We're on the side of the, what I heard recently, 200 million underground church members.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Edward Temperlake, and we're talking about, you know, the situation as far as China is concerned. And Edward was saying that there are reports that there may be as many as 200 million underground Christians in China, and certainly they deserve our support. I think they deserve a lot more support than we're giving them, because, of course, recently President Hu of China came to the United States and was honored by our president. Why would our president, our Christian president, even shake hands with that despicable, brutal tyrant? I just don't understand how we can do everything we can to give loans and insure loans and do everything we can to build up and secure this terrible, terrible tyranny, which certainly is one of the greatest tyranny in the history of the world. Why would, immediately after Tiananmen Square, when those brave young men stood up and faced the tanks in Tiananmen Square, why would George Bush go give most favored nation treaty status to communist China as a reward for what they've done? Just doesn't make any sense.
Well, the human rights element of China is a very powerful issue. And to be fair, I was on the Hill, Capitol Hill staff, on the Rules Committee for the late Chairman Jerry Solomon, a very strong advocate of American national security and very anti-People's Republic of China. He reached across the political aisle to very liberal Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, for example. And this is now, you're talking about a very conservative Republican chairman, and Nancy Pelosi is now head of the Democrats in the Congress, and they had of like purpose the philosophy and trying to get enough votes to stop the most favored nation status, to have Congress involve themselves and say, no, the People's Republic of China, you can't have most favored nation. By the way, that debate never happens now because they're now in the World Trade Organization, so you don't have that debate anymore.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be there if we hadn't let them
That's
in.
Correct. That is exactly right, sir. And the problem we had, and I'll never forget this, I was sitting there as this staffer in the debate. You would get both Republicans and liberal Democrats, centrist Democrats, come up, and they would vote on the economics of it. Their philosophy was trade will make China free. I think it was a fig leaf. I think it was a canard. I think I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I said, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Solomon said you're wrong. And it came to pass that the money that they collected in this trade war has built the Chinese military.
In other words, we've really contributed to building the best enemy American dollars can buy.
Yes, we have. Very bluntly, that is true.
Well, you know, it must be very frustrating for people back in Washington, D.C., like yourself, to see these things going on and realizing really how sort of helpless we are as this juggernaut moves forward. Hang on there. We'll be right back and just... Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Mr. Everett Temperlake, and we're talking about his book, and he's written it in conjunction with Jeff Babin, and it's entitled Showdown. And it not only goes into the background of the very real threat of Red China, but of course it gives a number of scenarios of what could happen that could lead us into a war with communist China, as our attention is focused on North Korea, as our focus is attention on Iraq, as our focus is attention on Iran and the threat of Iran, or certainly what's happening as far as the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And nobody talks about the very real threat of communist China, which, at least according to Mr. Temperlake, and I believe he's absolutely right, is in full military production for war. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement, and what they can't produce, they'll steal or buy. And they will steal it.
But, of course, under the Clinton administration, they didn't have to. Bill Clinton simply gave it to them, and when they were going to consider impeaching Bill Clinton, instead of Kenneth Starr talking about treason actions by our president, they talked about Monica Lewinsky and her stained dress.
I was called in, again, on the Rules Committee. I had the impeachment inquiry. I was the staffer that created the documentation that was voted on. I did the staff work on that. And my boss, again, the late Chairman Jerry Solomon, called me in and said, don't even think about the name Monica Lewinsky. This is going to be the wrong fight. Ed, keep your focus on the national security implications. He was a visionary. He was a strong guy, and he stood tall. Or he was a short man. And he really stood for keeping the focus on the threat of what Bill Clinton had done in selling out our secrets to the People's Republic of China. And that was very real, mind you. I'm not making that up. It's not crazy talk here. It's been documented in the first book I wrote, You're the Rat, 650 endnotes, and we laid out the entire spy case that was created through the for sale sign put in the front of the Clinton White House. That led to Year of the Rat. That Year of the Rat led to Red Dragon Rising. which was the beginning of the rise of the Chinese military. And then finally, Jed Babin and I took the documentation, open source. It's published in our book, by the way, the Defense Department report on China. And we extrapolated from that data the potential scenarios across the board, around the globe, on how China in various situations can attack and hurt America. And we're not Pollyanna here. This is not necessarily a very dramatic story with a happy ending. We end some of our scenarios where we do not succeed in the normal way in which Americans are used to seeing our country come out the other end, not only survive, but prevail in a very dramatic way. We are very hard-eyed, and we see some serious damage being done to America if we ever get in a war with China. I think our fellow citizens are tough enough to face these choices. Our goal is to awaken America, ring a fire bell in the night, to use something going back to the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, ringing a fire bell saying, awaken, the time is short, we need defenses, we need it thinking in these directions, because the People's Republic of China is on the march, they're growing their system, and if we stop them and deter them, which means tell them not to do it, and we'll hurt them worse than they think they can gain, maybe, just maybe, they'll crumble from within. I started with a 200 million Protestant church members. The Chinese government's under siege from the Vatican. We hope the Pope keeps up on this, because they've created a fake Catholic church in China, which I think is just disgusting. In addition, you did mention the president meeting the People's Republic of China president on the South Lawn arrival ceremony, and it was shown around the globe. The signal that the People's Republic of China is censoring its own people was when the practitioner, the female doctor, who is a practitioner of Falun Gong, started yelling at the head of China, the president. And that was blacked out in China within seconds, within a millisecond almost. That tells me that they're deathly afraid of the Falun Gong movement. I don't subscribe to it. I don't know as much about it. I haven't researched it as much as perhaps I should. But I do know that part of it is simple meditation, and the Chinese government tends to grab, this is a true story, grabs grandmothers by the hair and drags them out of Tiananmen for meditating. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff, because they can't stand it. Where do they go awry on treating their people? Well, half their banks are insolvent. I don't care how much money they have in trade surplus. That tends to go to the ruling princelings and the fascist dictators. They're not communists anymore. I think they're closer to Hitler's fascist mode, where they can use some private enterprise as instruments of state policy to keep their economy going. But here, if their banks in the hinterlands, in their peasant villages, are insolvent, that's a problem. They do have riots. They're just now passing a bill that you can't even talk about riots, and you can't publish anything about instability in China. I think they'll probably push that through. They don't really use the cover of the rule of law, but for some reason they tend to do it. When they grab a political prisoner, there have been, by reports, ABC News actually started the reporting, that of 60,000 political prisoners having their organs harvested after a capital crime. In other words, they put a bullet in your head, charge you for the bullet, and cut out your organs and put them on the open market. That is a very gruesome thing to even talk about in the 21st century, you know, of our existence here. That stuff is Orwellian, it's horrible, and the People's Republic of China have been accused of doing it, and I think from credible sources. This is the stuff that I think is very credible. And I go back to the ABC, Brian Ross reporting on this. The organ harvesting in China is just wrong. I mean, it's inconceivable that any modern or any government in this century could think that way and do that. It's Orwellian. So the bottom line is the American people have an issue. I think they, independent of our internal domestic politics, they better start rewarding and voting for and keeping in power politicians on both sides of the aisle that speak truth to power as far as communist China. But most importantly, I really do think that if we have the right votes, and I think they will continue, we will improve our anti-ballistic missile system to get back to where Jimmy Carter probably had it. We will increase our military, especially our Navy, because the Pacific is a wide ocean. We will increase our maneuver forces, our attack air, our B-2s, our uh, F-22s, the brand new Raptor, which is a miracle fighter plane. I wish I was younger and could fly it. And ultimately, hopefully, we will not have the subtitle of our book, Why Communist China Wants War with America, which our prediction is they want war because they can and will need to show at one point they can beat us to drive us out of the Pacific, which I think they really want. And once that happens, they own that half of the world. And they would be satisfied with that, of course, but they do like the ability to keep their neighbors at bay and turn them into vassal states. There is a bit of racism from the leaders of the People's Republic of China right now being directed towards Japan. I don't say that lightly. I like Japan. I think the Japanese are very decent and honorable and hardworking people. And what's getting reported out of Japan is a lot of the Japanese businessmen in China are being targeted, they're being bullied, they're being pushed around. I think the Chinese government has made a calculation, a political calculation, that by doing that, they may be able to take some of the pressure off their own shortcomings by giving their peasants and their emerging middle class kind of an object of venting of frustration or hate. It's again, almost Orwellian when he, in 1984, described the minutes of hate where governments use enemies to bring unity to their internal politics. I think the People's Republic of China have decided down that path on two counts so far. One, baiting Japan, and two, demanding reconciliation over Taiwan. Because to go down the Taiwanese path, to remind all your listeners, for the first time in 5,000 years recorded Chinese history, there was a free, fair, open, democratic election. Elections are not something that we in the West, you know, have a corner on. No, the Chinese people have showed that they understand how to switch parties through the ballot box, but they did it in Taiwan. That has to scare the heck out of the rulers in Beijing, because the last thing they need is an open and free ballot, an open and free First Amendment, where they'd be swept out of office within days because of their thuggish behavior. It is a very sticky situation that's evolving in China because of the internal pressures and the thinking I see and I can document that would allow them to relieve the internal pressures by venturing offshore again. And I'll repeat the list. I mean, they could do something on the Korean Peninsula. We have a whole scenario on that in Showdown. They could engage in a war with Japan, with America's in the middle of all these because we're there, or Taiwan, or oil. The statistics are very damning in that Americans basically consume about a 20 barrel a year consumption of oil. It's through our clothes, our driving, the manufacturing process. That's about our per capita consumption. China is one barrel per person. They got 1.3 billion. So can you imagine if they just come halfway up to our production at 10 barrels per what a demand that is for them to go after the oil reserves around the globe, which is what they're doing.
Let's take Mike, who's calling us from Arizona, and then we'll get back to that. Mike, sure. Did you have a quick question for our guest?
Yeah, sure do. I'm curious, what is the status on President Bush's request to have China doing the security at the port of the Bahamas, where they would be in a position of protecting us from nuclear weapons being smuggled into the country?
And they were also going to have Hutchison Wampo do the checking to protect us in Hong Kong. So what is the status of our using the Chinese communists to make sure that our incoming cartons are safe?
It's actually worse than the question posed, in that Hutchison Wampo grabbed both ends of the Panama Canal. I went head-to-head with Hutchison again off the Hill in the 90s when they tried to take over, and Costco tried to take over the port of Long Beach. We rolled them back, although, to be fair, they do also, we weren't totally successful. They still have unloading. And the threat from containers in oceans is huge. Hopefully, in the mouse and mousetrap game, our mousetrap of scanning containers and end user checks and origin, ports of origin checks are sufficient, but there is a tremendous flow, if you will, of shipping containers into America. And the Bush administration, I think, in one respect, and you know, they've got to deal with the world as it is, and you can only go so far offshore, said it best when they said, you know, we have to be 100% certain, 100% accurate and 100% capable, and bad guys only have to get 1% to really hurt us. And your listener accurately and appropriately pointed out that a lot of security on the issue of container shipping is critical. I am very concerned. Hutchinson Wampalo, especially that firm in the Panama region, a lot of indications are that not only do they, they People's Republic of China, ties, but that's where a lot of, smuggling occurs, a lot of criminal activity. It's hard to police because we don't have, we haven't committed the resources to places like the Panama and Bahamas. So it's a problem.
And we haven't even secured our southern border after almost 5 years of this tremendous terrorist attack, but maybe we'll do it next year. Mike, anything else?
No, sir. Thank you.
God bless. Thanks very much. And we got real problems, you know. If we're really involved with the war on terrorism, and I realize this is not your field, but I'm sure you must have talked about this up on the Hill. If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why has the president consistently refused to try to seal our southern border? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, your listeners have a very good point if they're concerned about that. I think they finally have come up with a formula that puts emphasis on two elements of it. The first is exactly what you're talking about, and they should be severed. The border security above and beyond everything is everything. That is it. Independent of that, you can have an amnesty debate or an immigration debate or buying your way into American citizenship debate, but sever the two arguments and focus principally on security first and foremost, and that way you don't have linkage and muddy the issues. So hold people responsible for securing the borders. That's absolutely accurate. I don't disagree with anything that's being done there. I think the administration has moved with the National Guard to recognize this fact. And the bottom line is, I think the debate finally has evolved into two parts, which each part then can be debated on the merits. And my number one merit, you say, I don't do much in this area, and you're right, except for security. And you put your finger right on the right word for the southern border, and actually the northern border also, after the Canadians, bravo to the Canadians. They rolled up a terror network up there that showed tremendous diligent police work. I know Canada has had differences with America. My mother lives up on that border, that's why I know. The bottom line is, during the course of my work against the People's Republic of China, some of the best writing of the 90s on stopping smuggling, stopping crimes out of China was from the Royal, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Mounties. They did magnificent work because they had a lot of threats from Chinese triad gangsters coming into Vancouver. So they came up and they started looking at that threat, and they did some magnificent work. So at one point, Canada really understood security. And again, it looks like the pendulum is coming back to that position after they rolled up that terrorist network, and then we rolled up our own homegrown bunch of goofs down in, terrorists, whatever they are, idiots, down in Florida. So the bottom line is, security is paramount, and it's both domestic, now we've proven, unfortunately and tragically, but it's also border security, north and south, and as your caller indicated, it's also shipping security.
All right. Now, of course, certainly aren't we having the triads coming in here? Don't we have a lot of Chinese intelligence agents getting into this country and even keeping track of some of the Chinese who are here who may not want to become informants, but they're really more or less terrorized by the long arm of communist China working right here in America?
Yes, sir. Chinese espionage is huge. Make no mistake about it. It is huge. It is unrelenting. It is 24/7. It is very capable. It is very clever, and it is very good. Make no mistake about it. The People's Republic of China, as you say, have created a very unique intelligence service. They use paid professionals. They use relatives. They use coercion. They set up and establish goals and objectives inside a certain box of parameters of what they need. They all coalesce to get it, and then they disband. It's not the old Soviet linear cases of having cells and cutouts and all that. They're very good at what they do, and they practiced very well under Bill Clinton's watch. by getting away with it. It is now incumbent upon the administration to awaken, which they are, and our Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is very good, to awaken to the threat of Chinese espionage and do something actively against it. And I think the American people are being well served by the thinking in Washington that recognize this fact and are prepared to act with resources, skill, and the full force of the American justice system to stop espionage. In fact, last Friday...
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Our guest has been Edward Temperlake. His book, Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States. And Chris, if you'd like to get it, give us a call.
Thank you, sir.
Edward, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay.
Go right ahead. So you're basically saying that you think that the administration is finally getting around to doing something about the Chinese espionage. There was a story recently about this woman who was sleeping with one of the FBI agents and stealing all of our secrets, and they gave her a slap on the wrist, and she admitted to it.
Things are changing, sir, and I'll tell you why. Last Friday, Bill Gertz, my fellow author from Regnery, a very capable reporter, reported a story in the Washington Times that they nailed. When the leading PhDs in the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Asian Pacific Center out in Hawaii, who was an apologist agent of influence for the People's Republic of China, he pled guilty to spying for China.
What are they going to do with him?
What's that?
What are they going to do with him?
We don't know. The sentencing is in September. I hope they throw the book at him. And I also hope they find out who his connections were, who his contacts were, and who his buddies were who were doing the same thing. I think this is a big signal to the community that apologizes for China for personal gain or for ideological reasons. When they start stepping over the line and giving classified information offshore to the People's Republic of China, they will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. It's happening. The tide is turning on that issue. I really have a sense of comfort that we'll fail. I mean, nothing's perfect. But you know what? There's a real strong and healthy attitude in Washington to stop this stuff. And kudos and bravo to the Bush administration for this attitude of zero tolerance in letting secret documents go offshore.
One of the things that really disturbs me, and I'm sure you're probably acquainted with this fact, that the Export-Import Bank, an American division of our government, is actually guaranteeing loans so that China can build nuclear power plants, 5 of them. Why are we doing that?
I don't know. Sir, I'm sorry, I'm talking from Washington, and don't tell anybody, but at times Washington is inconsistent and confusing.
I don't mean to pin you down.
I know. It perplexes me, and I live here.
I know you do, and I know how frustrating it must be, and I feel better knowing that you and Jeff and a few people back there who really do care about America are working there within the structure of government, trying to at least block some of these things which seem to be organized insanity. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. I want to thank you very much for being, for being our guest several times and for writing your book, Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States. I hope our listeners will heed your warning.
I do too, sir. Thank you for having me on. It's very good to talk with you.
Goodbye and God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, it was Edward Temperlake. And there's just so many unanswered questions. And, of course, I think that maybe we have to recognize that nothing is as it appears to be. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and during the break, I had a chance to ask Mr. Temperlake why it is, with all of these things we know about Communist China, that the Export-Import Bank, which is a subdivision of our own government, is guaranteeing a $5 billion loan to Communist China so that they can build 5 nuclear power plants. So we're going to build the nuclear power plants for them, whereas we're so concerned about Iran having exactly the same sort of power plant in Iran. So many of these things don't make sense unless you understand that there are other forces working behind the scenes. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or heard the video or watched the video in the DVD, you need to get it. You need to understand there is another dimension out there which everybody is ignoring. If you have not yet seen my interview with Professor Sutton before he died, it's called The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, going into how the United States funded Communist Russia, how the United States funded Communist China, how the United States funded North Vietnam during the Vietnamese War while they were killing our boys. And of course, it was the Ford plant at Gorky in Russia that was building the trucks. That and the Kama River plant, which we built for Russia, the largest truck plant in the entire world. We built it for Russia while they were funding the North Vietnamese and shipping those trucks that were built in our plant that we financed and built for the Russians, shipping them to North Vietnam so they could carry the weapons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kill American boys. And none of this makes sense unless you understand that there's another agenda. You need to get our interview, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. We carry the book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, by Professor Sutton. So there's a video and a book. And then, of course, there's certainly the four-tape set on Vietnam or the Vietnam special, which will point out to you that we at any time could have won the war in Vietnam within 2 months. We were never allowed to. I was personally told that by Ambassador William Sullivan, H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Laos during the war and actually went to Paris with Kissinger. I interviewed him back at Columbia University. Didn't get it on film. I regret that. General Lewis Walt told me exactly the same thing. We could have won the war at any time, and we never did. In fact, we were doing everything we could to keep the North Vietnamese government in power. And then let's fast forward to where we are in Iraq. Why don't we send in sufficient troops and end the war? Why don't we cut off the funding that is going to the Al-Qaeda terrorists? Where is this coming from? Why, our good friends in Saudi Arabia, and of course they have 55 terrorist training camps in Pakistan. And who's funding Pakistan? We are. Nothing is as it appears to be. We are building the largest embassy anywhere in the world. It's cost well over $1 billion now. It'll probably cost $2 or $3 billion, at least $2 billion, before it's completed. If we're planning on pulling out of Iraq, why are we building the largest embassy anywhere in the world right there in Baghdad? And the reason is we're not planning on pulling out. They will tell you one thing, but we're going to keep our troops there indefinitely. That is the plan. And if you doubt that, you need to read the writings of the Project for the New American Century, to which Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton and Liddy and Zalmid Khalilzad, and they all come from the Project for the New American Century. It's all in my syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. That's Iraq, the Untold Story. You want to get it, you want to read it, you want to hear my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story. Understand that all the wars are fought for far different reasons than the young men we sent overseas to fight and die are ever to be allowed to know. The Spanish-American War, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea. Why did we go to war with Korea? It was a great distraction. Americans were saying, why did our government turn over Eastern Europe and China to the communists? Which they did. So we needed to divert the American people, so we went to war in Korea, but we never tried to win. Same thing is true with Vietnam. We never tried to win. And then we had the first Gulf War, and now the second Gulf War. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And please pray for Radio Liberty.